985-5735, 985-KPFK. Oh, boy. Matthew. Oops. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I turned you down here. All right. We have the atomic bomb, the end of World War II.
Yeah, now we're up to... We've been talking for almost an hour, and we haven't even gone to the Pacifica Foundation yet.
Well, now we're getting to the point where usually we begin, right?
Yes, this is where the Pacifica Foundation starts. Well, Lewis Hill and Joy Hill, they got themselves an apartment on Schrader Street. Lewis Hill wrote a whole letter, and I read it, about how wonderful this apartment was. And Hill understood where he had to go if he was going to get the person power he needed to get this show on the road. Which is that there was this thing in San Francisco, it was called the San Francisco Literary Renaissance. We remember it as people like Jack Spicer and Kenneth Rexroth and Helen Adam. And these wonderful poets. This is before the Beat Movement.
This is before the Beats.
Yes, this is before the Beat Movement.
And related to the Beats.
Well, the Beats took some of their inspiration from these people. But they predate Ginsberg and Kerouac, these individuals. And there's a wonderful new book out. I haven't read it yet, but I'm trying to get a copy of it. It's called Poet Be Like God, and it's about Jack Spicer, who was one of the individuals in this particular world. Lewis Hill understood that these people, many of whom had been conscientious objectors during the Second World War, including Kenneth Rexroth, who had worked in a mental institution during the Second World War, would be crucial to developing this project. And so, there were these things in San Francisco called the Libertarian Circle meetings. Some people have called them the Liberation Circle meetings. I got different names from different individuals who I did oral histories with, so I can't really be sure what the name of them were. But they were basically a whole bunch of anarcho-pacifists who would get together, and they would have discussion groups. And mostly, these things were run by Kenneth Rexroth, who was that very, very important voice of the San Francisco Bay Area. And they were held frequently in the house of Richard Moore, who became a close friend of Lewis Hill, and who now lives on the California coast, and who I interviewed. And one day, Lewis Hill and Joy Hill showed up. We know about this meeting initially because Kenneth Rexroth wrote about it in his autobiography. But basically, Lewis Hill showed up unannounced at this meeting, and he gave this idea. He put out this idea about this radio station. Wouldn't it be good to have this radio station? And the world has gone through this big structural change, and now we can use the electronic media to put forth the pacifist message. And Rexroth, who was frequently threatened by ideas that he didn't initiate himself, scoffed at the idea, and they had apparently this wonderful argument in which Lewis Hill demonstrated his amazing capacity for wearing down an opponent with a bunch of sort of persistent questions, and they had a debate, and at the end of the debate, a lot of the people in the room were convinced that Lewis Hill was right, that this would be a very good idea. And from this, Lewis Hill recruited the early pacifists who became part of the Pacifica Foundation project. And over a period of 3 years, it took a very long time, they raised the money. They raised it through a series of fundraising prospectuses. They raised the money, and they eventually got KPFA on the air. Now, there are some interesting things about KPFA that people don't generally know. One of them was that when Hill started making plans for KPFA, he didn't want it to be in Berkeley. Did you know that?
No.
He didn't want it to be in Berkeley.
That's an ideal place.
No, he wanted it to be in Richmond, California. See, he wanted it to be in Richmond, California, because Richmond at that time was an industrial boom town. During the Second World War, Henry Kaiser had put these shipyards in Richmond, and the place had gone from a city of about 24,000 people to 100,000 people overnight. Huge working class audience. And Hill, who was who thought that the future was in some ways with the working class, wanted to reach beyond the pacifist in crowd. He wanted to get a broad and diverse audience, and he saw Richmond as this very broad and diverse audience. And so he wrote a fundraising prospectus in which he posited Richmond, California. He and his friends posited Richmond, California as the place where this station would be. And it would not be an FM radio station. They wanted an AM radio station.
FM was pretty blank at the time, and nobody had a receiver.
Well, the story of FM is that in 1935, the first Sirius FM stations went on the air, and they were developed over the next few years. But RCA saw FM as a threat to its new toy, which was television. The only thing that they wanted FM to have anything to do with was that they wanted FM for their TV sets, for the sound receivers for their TV sets. But they didn't want FM to become widespread, because they wanted everybody to focus on television. This was the strategy of RCA. During the Second World War, and in 1945, in a series of hearings which took place at the Museum of Natural History, the FCC, in cahoots with RCA, basically marginalized FM. They created a series of laws and regulations which made it very, very difficult to use FM effectively. They pushed it all the way to the area of the bandwidth which it's currently in, which completely created havoc with all the current FM radio stations at that time. And they limited how big FM stations could be. The result was that nobody really wanted to have an FM station, and there were hardly any FM stations. Hardly anybody had FM receivers, as you've just said. And so Hill did not want to have an FM station. He wanted to have an AM station. But when he lobbied for the FCC for an AM station, he quickly discovered that the competing networks wouldn't let him lobbied against it, and they stopped KPFA, they stopped the Pacifica Foundation from getting an AM signal. At that point, around 1947, 1948, the people in the radio committee of the Pacifica Foundation all sat around together, and they hired a high-priced consultant of about $75 an hour. And they realized that they couldn't get an AM signal anywhere in the Bay Area. And they realized that if they wanted to have any kind of a radio station at all, it would have to be an FM station, and it would have to be in Berkeley, because Berkeley was the only place in the area where there were any people who had FM receivers. There were a lot of technical people there, and there were a lot of affluent people because of the university who had FM receivers. And the minutes of 1947 have a very interesting and provocative statement, in which they say, "It looks like we will have to have a smaller and more exclusive audience than originally envisioned." At this point, Hill began to realize what many people in public radio have had to face, whether they wanted to or not, which is that whatever your dreams and ideals are, it's a relatively small and affluent audience that frequently pays for public radio in the United States, a country where there isn't much of a public sector and which the government doesn't support the public sector very well, like it does in England or Germany. So it was at this point that the Pacifica Foundation went for an FM signal in Berkeley. And over a period of 2 years, they very gradually got the money together. And on April 15, 1949, KPFA went on the air at 3 o'clock. That was the point at which it went on the air. When it went on the air, the descriptions of it are absolutely euphoric and very, very funny. Gertrude Chiarito wrote a brief description of it in which she described being in charge of throwing some switches as Lewis Hill and Richard Moore went on the air. And she had a switch that said Lou, and she had a switch that said Richard, and she put them on, and the first thing that they did was some kind of a folk music show. And afterwards, she went out of the studio, and she went into the main room on University Avenue, where the first KPFA studios were, and she found half of the people in the room crying and half the people in the room drinking alcohol directly from bottles, just hysterically happy or hysterically hysterical that this thing had actually happened. Shortly after that, the people in the audience in the studio began sitting around, and they started thinking, "Is anybody actually listening to us?" And there was sort of this emotional anxiety which built throughout this first hour. Is anybody actually listening to us? And somebody then called on the telephone and said, "I can hear you. Congratulations and welcome to Berkeley." And everybody just jumped up with joy. And that was the very first hour that the Pacifica Foundation had on the air.
It works. Gert Chiarito did a program in the 1950s called The Midnight Special.
It was a very important program.
I did my radio debut on The Midnight Special about 1958, maybe 1959. I was on Gert Chiarito's program twice.
What did you do?
I played the banjo and sang.
You know, I have to ask you a question, because I never met Gert Chiarito. You know, this is all just historian stuff that I've done. What was she like?
I haven't the foggy. It was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was with her for, you know, in a small group of folkies for about an hour. And I don't even have a picture of her in my mind.
Well, she was a very dedicated programmer. And, of course, as you know, Midnight Special was a very important program.
Yes.
In which people from the Grateful Dead got their debut on the radio. In which many other people, one of the people who was a very important force and who really, in a sense, started it was a local musician around here. His name is Barry Olivier. Barry Olivier.
He had the barrel. The barrel.
Yeah, and anyway, he was one of the two teenagers who really started the Midnight Special, and then Gertrude Chiarito took the show over.
Yeah, Barry Olivier was sort of the folk central in Berkeley.
Well,
I remember him, Barry, very well.
Well, he was a very important force in that show. So that basically is a kind of a nutshell version of everything that happened until KPFA actually went on the air.
On the air. And they got one phone call. We've had a couple here, too, and we have four more books to give away. We're talking with Matthew Lazar, L-A-S-A-R, Matthew Lazar. He's the author of a brand new book. Still, the ink is still wet, and it's called Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, Temple University Press, 320 pages. If you would like to not only read this fascinating, amazing history for yourself, if you're one of the few who is interested in this institution, which has been a catalyst, in my belief, for a lot of things that have happened of great importance in our society the last 50 years. Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network by Matthew Lazar. We have four copies left. We want you to get one and, at the same time, be a contributor to the institution as it exists in 1999. And you can get your copy of Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, with a $100 contribution to KPFK, one of the children of five children of Pacifica. Area code 818-985-5735, 985-KPFK. Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network by Matthew Lazar, with a $100 contribution to KPFK. We'll accept Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or Discover. And with a $100 contribution, you can be one of the four people left who can get hold of this fascinating book, which I'm looking forward to getting. Area code 818-985-5735, 985-KPFK. We have four left. Okay, Matthew.
Well, I want to thank you very much for having me on. I want to close with one little observation about Lewis Hill and his vision. You know, Lewis, you probably are familiar with the fact that Lewis Hill had this thing called the 2% theory, right? He wrote a book called Voluntary Listener Sponsorship just before he took his own life in 1957. In which he argued that any radio station in any metropolitan area could, could basically run itself if it got 2% of the listening audience to subscribe. I argue in my book, I wondered out loud in my book, where did he get this figure, 2%? I mean, where did that come from? He writes that it's statistical math or something like that. He has all these vague explanations. I really think that it comes from an old pacifist idea, which was actually first outlined by Einstein, who was an ardent war resister, in the 1930s. In 1930, Albert Einstein, gave a speech, to a group of pacifists at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in, New York City, in which he said that if 2% of the people of any nation, specifically the men of any nation, were to resist the draft, if just 2% were to do so, it would be very, very difficult for any nation to really seriously prosecute any war. And I think that Lewis Hill had an extraordinarily optimistic vision about the human spirit. and about the possibility of what people could do, of what even a small group of people could do if they really put their mind to it. And I think that the Pacifica Foundation has really fulfilled that vision, and it's really fulfilled that vision in a very special way. None of the things which we associate with American progressivism since the Second World War would have been on the radio in any serious mass way if it had not been for the Pacifica Foundation. Starting with the fact that in 1949, Lewis Hill went on one of the first things he did when he got on KPFA was he told people not to cooperate with the FBI. He gave a speech in which he told people, if the FBI comes to your door, just don't cooperate with them. Just say no.
Which
just
is your legal right.
Huh?
Which is your legal right, which,
you know,
people weren't aware of.
People weren't aware of. Just say no. You have the right not to cooperate with them. But, you know, over the years, many people on Pacifica Radio have come out against, have come out against the CIA, and they've come out against the FBI for the various very immoral things that they've done. But to do that in 1949, a year of profound repression throughout the United States, the dawn of the Smith Act, the trial of the Rosenbergs, the trial of Alger Hiss, the incarceration of the Hollywood Ten, to do that in 1949 on the radio was an extraordinary act of bravery that I find almost incomprehensible that he should have done that on the radio. And, of course, the Pacifica Foundation, I could just go on and on and on. The Pacifica Foundation openly questioned the war in Korea in the early 1950s. It openly questioned McCarthyism long before network television questioned McCarthyism. In 1958, Elsa Knight Thompson broadcast the first comprehensive gay rights documentary that it was ever on the radio. Interviews with psychiatrists and criminologists and members of the Mattachine Society. In the early 1960s, the Pacifica Foundation interviewed two dissident FBI agents on both coasts, so both WBAI in New York City and in KPFA, on an act which won them complete FBI surveillance and subpoenaed by the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, which basically threw the foundation into a tailspin ordeal, which it almost did not survive. The Pacifica Foundation had sent the first reporter to North Vietnam. The Pacifica Foundation was the only network in the early 1990s to seriously question the morality of the Persian Gulf War, of the United States prosecution of the Persian Gulf War. If it had not been for the Pacifica Foundation, none of those voices would have been heard the way they were heard. It's a truly remarkable thing, and I'm very proud to have been part of it, and I'm sure you are also. And I hope that people will subscribe to this station so that we can have that for another 50 years.
Before you get off the hook here, one of the earliest voices of people fomenting and creating Pacifica and KPFA, who still is a regular part of this program, was Alan Watts.
Alan Watts, yes, absolutely.
You have a lot to say. You have a lot to say about him. Could you sort of talk about Alan Watts for a few minutes before you go?
Well, you know, Alan Watts, of course, was a very important voice in early KPFA. He was one of the four most important commentators in early KPFA, the other ones being Pauline Kael, who did movie reviews, Felix Green, who played a very important role in coverage of Chinese affairs during the later 1950s and mid-1950s at KPFA, and, of course, Kenneth Rexroth himself. What made Alan Watts so special, I think, and so important, was that, unlike so many New Age people who were on the radio, Alan Watts really met the listener halfway. Richard Moore told me a wonderful story about recruiting Alan Watts. He basically got him from the American Asian Institute, which is an institute in San Francisco, and brought him into the station, and he put him in front of a microphone with a tape recorder on, and he said to Alan Watts, "Well, do you have any paper? Do you have anything a script you'd like to read from?" And Watts said, "No, I don't have any script. I'll just talk. You tell me what time it is." And Watts produced a perfectly timed 15-minute talk on Zen, 15 minutes to the second, without any prompt, any writing, any literature in front of him. Moore was just absolutely astonished. What made Alan Watts so special was that his capacity, I think, and still makes him an important voice, was his capacity to meet listeners halfway. He understood that the concepts which he was talking about, Buddhism, Zen, reincarnation, spirituality, the concept of being one with the universe, of not being an isolated self, of not just being a body, but being one with the entire universe. These were very, very difficult ideas for people to accept. He spoke slowly, and he spoke using logic and language in such a way that you understood that he was really trying to take the effort to convince you that what he was talking about was true. He used concepts that people in the United States were familiar with. Christianity, psychoanalysis. I'm sure that you're familiar with his wonderful talk about psychoanalysis and Zen.
The art of psychoanalysis. 1, 2, 3. Yes.
Yes. Well, what makes that talk so great is that he is obviously trying so hard to find links to Western culture, links between Eastern and Western culture, and not just throwing these concepts in the sort of breezy way at people, but taking the time. You notice the way he always pauses between sentences.
Yeah.
He wants to give you that little breathing space to think. And that's what made Alan Watts such a great genius. And that's, of course, one of the things that put KPFA on the map. KPFA also put Alan Watts on the map. But both of them had this mutually reciprocal relationship. And that he was one of the people who really made KPFA such an important force so quickly for so many people. I interviewed people in the 1950s who had listened to KPFA in the 1950s who were just astonished at KPFA. I mean, they were just astonished that this thing had come into their lives. I interviewed people who told me that they decided not to take jobs in lucrative jobs in other places in the United States because they did not want to be outside of KPFA's air sound.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think that Alan Watts played a very important role in that.
Oh, right. Well, thank you, Matthew Lazar.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really looking forward to reading this book, and my congratulations for putting it together, a historical document of great importance to many of us.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks very much.
And good luck with it, and I'll probably talk to you another time.
I hope so. Thanks a lot.
Good night.
Good night.
Matthew Lazar. LASAR. He's the author of Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network.